Well, welcome back to week two of GI Physiology. We're talking about peptides of the GI tract. And we'll start out with just a general classification of peptides as hormone, paracrine, and neurocrine or neurotransmitter peptides. So in general, hormones are released into the circulation, in this case, the portal circulation. They reach potentially all tissues of the body. And so with hormones, the specificity of their function really occurs at the target tissue level based on specific receptor types. Paracrine function involves the release of peptides through the extracellular space to target tissues that are nearby. This is often limited by diffusion, although if there are abundant numbers of cells that are scattered throughout large areas can reach large areas. And often these paracrine peptides act on endocrine cells to increase or decrease release of hormones. And then neurocrine, neurotransmitter peptides are released by nerve endings. They travel short distance across the synaptic gap. But again, they may have larger scale functions if they modulate the release of either endocrine hormones or paracrine peptides. So in this light, all hormones in the GI tract are peptides, but not all peptides are hormones. We're going to go through a series of the most common GI peptides, and I'm going to break this down just to give you an overview into gastrin, which will be its own segment, cholecystokinin or CCK, which will be its own segment, secretin, which will be its own segment, and then we'll wrap up talking about somatostatin, motilin, gastric inhibitory peptide, and a variety of other candidate hormones that are discussed in some of the resources. So the first peptides that we're going to speak about are gastrin and cholecystokinin. These are in a sort of shared class in that they have very similar structures and some overlapping functions. So they have the same five C-terminal amino acids, that's in contrast to the N-terminus, and they each have what's called a minimal fragment needed for their maximum biological activity. So for gastrin, the minimal fragment is the final four amino acids, and for cholecystokinin, it's the final five amino acids. There are some other modifications that can happen, such as sulfated tyrosine amino acid that is in the sixth position on gastrin and the seventh position from the C-terminus on cholecystokinin, and that can change to some extent the functions of either gastrin or cholecystokinin. The receptors for these are also very similar, but have different affinities for the different hormones. So the CCK1 receptor has the strongest affinity for cholecystokinin. The CCK2 receptor has the strongest affinity for gastrin, but they can activate the other receptor to some extent. These final segments of gastrin and cholecystokinin are amidated, so there's an amine moiety that's able to help protect these molecules from the carboxypeptidases and enzymes that would otherwise, as peptides, inactivate them in the intestine. And they also allow for some specificity and maximal activity biologically. The old terms for CCK1, the cholecystokinin predominant receptor and CCK2, or the gastrin's main receptor, where CCKA for alimentary and CCKB for brain. So A and B are now 1 and 2. And just remember that 1 is for cholecystokinin, 2 is for gastrin, although there's some overlap. So that said, the locations of these receptors, although they're scattered throughout the GI tract, CCK2, or the gastrin receptor, it is found on parietal cells, but it's also actually found in the most abundant numbers of receptors on the enterochromaffin-like cells of the stomach, which we'll talk more about later. And then CCK1 is found more in the pancreas as well as the gallbladder. And CCK1 receptor has a 1,000-fold higher affinity for cholecystokinin than gastrin. And all of these, just to wrap up sort of this introduction, are G protein coupled receptors, which we'll talk a little bit more about later on. So we'll start going through the specific hormones and peptides with a discussion of gastrin. This is the major hormonal regulator of gastric acid secretion. I'll say that again. As many of you know, gastrin is the main trigger for gastric acid secretion. And it's important to note now, so we can reiterate later, the main way that gastrin does this is not by direct stimulation of the parietal cell to produce hydrochloric acid, although it does do that as well. But the main or predominant way that gastrin increases acid secretion from the parietal cells is actually through a middleman, or middle cell, the ECL cells, or the enterochromaffin-like cells. And it stimulates those to produce histamine, which then acts on the parietal cells. And that is thought to be the primary trigger for acid secretion. Gastrin, like a lot of these peptides, is initially a larger peptide of 101 amino acids. It's cleaved into 34 and then 17 amino acid segments. The 34 amino acid version is called sometimes big gastrin. 17 amino acid version is called little gastrin. These are actually equipotent, but little gastrin, the 17 amino acid form, is about 90% of the meal-related antral gastrin that's released from the G cells. And this increases in response to a meal 2 to 3 times from the baseline amounts. The tetrapeptide, again, as we discussed in one of the introductory segments, that last 4 amino acids that's amidated, that has an amine moiety on it, is what gives gastrin its full biological activity. So we're going to take a similar format in going through all of these peptides. So we're going to go through where they're from, what are the stimuli for release, what are the inhibitors, and then what do they do. So where does gastrin come from? The majority of it comes from the G cells of the antrum. There are smaller amounts scattered elsewhere in the duodenum, and less so further down in the rest of the small bowel, the non-antral stomach, pancreas, perhaps colon. It can be expressed ectopically in non-endocrine cells, such as tumors. And so one of the recurring themes that you'll hear with a lot of these peptides is that in addition to their functions in stimulating secretion and a variety of other things, many of them have trophic effects, which are perhaps just as important. And in the case of gastrin and several of the other ones, is postulated to potentially have some oncogenic potential, meaning too much stimulation of trophic growth could potentially promote tumorigenesis. What are the stimuli for gastrin secretion? So Protein is one of the biggest ones, so it can be protein, peptides, amino acids. The greatest amount of gastrin secretion is when those nutrients are in direct contact with the G cells in the antrum. And so we'll talk a little bit later about why oftentimes when food is diverted away from this area for various reasons, that can affect gastrin secretion. So protein, peptides, amino acids. Another important one is distension. And so this can be in relation to normal physiology of a meal entering the stomach and causing distension. It can be in the setting of gastric outlet obstruction. All of those things can stimulate increased gastrin. So proteins, amino acids. Second one is distension. Hypercalcemia can do it. One of the chapters goes through decaffeinated coffee as an interesting stimulant, although how much this matters physiologically is perhaps not so much. Another important one is a high pH. So an alkaline pH, as food enters the stomach and somewhat dilutes some of the baseline acidity, that is another trigger for gastrin release. And then gastrin-releasing peptide, which is a release from the postganglionic fibers of the vagus nerve, is another one that can do that. Retained gastric antrum, which is an older complication of a Billroth II procedure, where there is a basically an excluded or blind duodenal limb that has some retained portion of the antrum. And because it is no longer bathed in a typical acid bath, and because there's still secretions from the duodenum causing an alkaline situation, that can cause significantly elevated amounts of gastrin and can actually cause peptic ulcer disease. So that is another less commonly seen now, but often asked about and discussed cause of gastrin secretion. So in summary, I think it's important to just kind of highlight again, proteins and peptides and amino acids, distension, and then high pH or alkaline pH. And finally, this neurologic related gastrin releasing peptide from the vagus nerve. So inhibitors of gastrin secretion include fasting. So you can think about this just the opposite of what stimulates it in many cases. When you eat a meal and there's peptides in proximity to the G cells, it stimulates gastrin release. So if you're not eating and that's not happening, gastrin secretion is inhibited. Acidic pH, so if the antral mucosal pH drops under 3.5, and then somatostatin, which works in a paracrine fashion from cells we'll talk about later, the D cells, which are also most heavily located in the antrum, and inhibit the release of gastrin. So what does gastrin do? It increases acid secretion. And we talked about this before. There is a mechanism in which it directly stimulates the parietal cells, but there's also an indirect and more important, actually, stimulus through a middle cell called the enterochromaffin-like, or ECL, cells. And it stimulates these to make histamine, which then acts upon the parietal cells as well. And this is the main stimulus for acid secretion. In addition to increasing acid secretion, it stimulates pancreatic bicarb and enzyme secretion to some extent, again, working kind of on the cholecystokinin receptors, which there's some overlap of function between gallbladder contraction, motility to some extent. It also stimulates chief cells to release pepsinogen, which is then cleave to the active form pepsin. And so that makes a lot of sense. We're increasing acid secretion, which helps to activate pepsinogen. And so all of these things are kind of happening in parallel, simultaneously, in order to begin the digestion process. So it stimulates acid secretion, chief cells to release pepsinogen. And then there's also this important trophic effect that we talked about previously on the auxiliary glands of the stomach. So this is the G cells and the enterochromaffin-like cells, as well as in the small intestine and colon. And so if you look post-antrectomy, after you remove the antrum and the G cells, there's atrophy of a lot of these portions in the stomach, the small intestine, and the colon. And giving exogenous gastrin can prevent this. Likewise, in hypersecretory states, there's often enterochromaffin-like cell hyperplasia and increased parietal cell mass. And this can actually, specifically the enterochromaffin-like cell hyperplasia, can actually lead to carcinoid tumors in two of the three types of gastric carcinoids, which are associated with elevated gastrin levels. And then lastly, gastrin does have a role in mediating gastrocolic reflex. It does have some functions in relaxing the pylorus and the ileocecal valve. So we're going to talk now about hypergastrinemic states. And the most important question off the bat is, are they making acid or not? And so this is something that you can at least attempt to do a quick test with litmus paper and some secretions suctioned up during an endoscopy. This is important because there are a lot of very common things that cause hypergastrinemia that are not Zollinger-Ellison syndrome. And so the most common two are actually achlorhydric states related to proton pump inhibitor use and chronic atrophic gastritis. So remember, acidic states or fasting causes a decreased secretion of gastrin, and the alkaline pH will cause an elevated gastrin levels, increases the secretion. And so proton pump inhibitors obviously cause alkaline pH by blocking the proton potassium ATPases in the parietal cells, and chronic atrophic gastritis can destroy the parietal cells. And there are two flavors of this. One is the autoimmune variety, which is classically pernicious anemia. And so that is one of the states actually in which there are very, very high sometimes gastrin levels, even upwards of 1,000. The other one is in later, more chronic stages of Helicobacter pylori, in which the infection has kind of migrated from the antrum into the body and corpus. And in that state, the parietal cells' function is decreased because they're making less acid, and you get more of an alkaline pH. Then you end up with hypergastrinemia in response to that. And so, you know, chronic atrophic gastritis, whether it's autoimmune or Helicobacter pylori related, and proton pump inhibitor use are two things that are very common. And so knowing whether they're making acid or not can really help you to sort this out, because in somebody who is who has an alkaline pH baseline, it's very unlikely that that person has Zollinger-Ellison syndrome. So Zollinger-Ellison syndrome is a tumor making gastrin, most often are located in the duodenum or pancreas. Pancreas is a bit more common. The levels of gastrin can range from 150 to 1,000 picograms per milliliter. But again, the level alone can be misleading because of some of these other conditions that can cause elevated gastrins. There's some other changes that you see with the chronic hypersecretion of gastrin, such as increased parietal cell mass, which then leads to increased acid secretory capacity. And then, of course, the gastrin also directly stimulates these cells to make acid. So it's the increased stimulation directly of the parietal cells and also the increased parietal cell mass and the capacity that mass has to secrete acid. So these patients, classically, we think about peptic ulcer disease, especially post-duodenal bulb. So if you see multiple scattered ulcers past the duodenal bulb, it's something that we need to think about. Patients also suffer from diarrhea, and that's both from the acidic environment inactivating or preventing activation of pancreatic enzymes, which, if you remember, need do not activate until there's a bit more of an alkaline pH. And then these patients can also get diarrhea in addition to sort of the malabsorption from inactivation of pancreatic enzymes. There's also just the overwhelming fluid volume from increased gastric secretion, which can be 2 to 3 liters over sort of the baseline. In patients without Zollinger-Ellison syndrome, but with peptic ulcers, most fasting gastrins are less than 100 picograms per milliliter. In Helicobacter pylori, most of the peptic ulcers related to H. pylori are in the state of a gastrin of less than 150 picograms per milliliter. Again, that's fasting. Zollinger-Ellison syndrome is strongly suggested when the gastrin's over 1,000 picograms per milliliter, as long as they are not in an achlorhydric state. So again, that's the importance of checking the pH at endoscopy, and roughly a pH level of less than 3 means that patient's making a good amount of acid still. If they're not acidic, if the pH is not less than 3, it's probably very unlikely they have Zollinger-Ellison syndrome. In Zollinger-Ellison syndrome, as we mentioned before, the gastrin is almost always above 150, can be as high as 100,000 in rare instances. But it's important to check this fasting, and ideally off of a PPI, because that can, of course, cause elevated gastrins by itself. The challenge in some of these patients where there's a high clinical suspicion, there's already ulcer disease that's known about, is that there's some concern about withdrawing proton pump inhibitor therapies, is that there's some concern that this could increase the risk of worsening of peptic ulcer disease and bleeding and perforation. And so it's not always possible to do that. So you have to document gastric acid hypersecretion in addition to the hypergastrinemia to really go down the path of Zollinger-Ellison syndrome. Ideally, and classically, you do this with measuring basal and peak acid outputs after you give a gastrin analog called pentagastrin to stimulate. And both of these typically increase more in Zollinger-Ellison syndrome, and the ratio of basal to peak increases significantly more after pentagastrin in Zollinger-Ellison syndrome than in a regular duodenal ulcer. The basal acid output being above 15 milliequivalents per hour is also very suggestive. All of this said, one of the more common ways that this diagnosis is often sought now, though, is using a secretin test, and so this may come up on board exams too. So normally, secretin should actually cause a decrease in gastrin production. However, when you give a patient with Zollinger-Ellison syndrome an injection of secretin, it actually causes a paradoxical increase. And if that increase is above 120 picograms per milliliter, then this is considered relatively confirmatory for a Zollinger-Ellison syndrome. There are some things that can cause false positive tests that I won't go into in detail. Once this diagnosis is biochemically established, so high gastrin, they're making acid, they have a positive secretin stimulation test, then you need to try to localize the tumor, but there should be one sort of pause at this point in time. Because about 25% of Zollinger-Ellison syndrome cases are associated or part of MEN1, multiple endocrine neoplasia syndromes. And so typically, if you have a Zollinger-Ellison syndrome case, you want to stop and check calcium, parathyroid hormone levels. And then the definitive test for MEN1 is the menin, M-E-N-I-N gene analysis. So after you've kind of stopped and paused and thought, could this be a non-sporadic Zollinger-Ellison syndrome and maybe part of MEN1, then you need to try to find the tumor. And this is often quite challenging. So there are a number of radiographic as well as interventional radiology procedures ranging from CT and MRI, ultrasounds, endoscopic ultrasounds, to arteriography and selective portal venous sampling for gastrin. However, the octreotide scans and the newer, more sensitive dotatate scan, instead of using indium, are actually very effective and can often help in locating these tumors. So just to know that, you know, after you've biochemically established this and you've thought about whether this could be MEN1 syndrome, you need to try to find it. And there's a movement towards these using dotatate labeled scans. However, the classic octreotide that's labeled with 111 indium is still used in many instances. And then finally, just to hit on the goal of treatment in these cases, it's nice when you can find it and cut it out, but controlling acid hypersecretion is important. So a lot of times these are increased doses of PPIs. A common starting place would be at 60 milligrams BID of omeprazole, for instance. And if you're able to get a baseline measurement of, basal and peak acid outputs, it's nice to see that decrease. Not always possible. In the past, they used a lot of vagotomies to try to decrease acid secretion, although that's it's relatively uncommon that that's necessary now with the advent of PPIs. And then it's important to know, especially in the setting of Zollinger-Ellison syndrome that's part of MEN1 syndrome, it's very common to get gastric carcinoid tumors of the enterochromaffin-like or ECL cells that may be due to this kind of prolonged and extreme gastrin hypersecretion and the trophic effect of gastrin. And I think that is nearing the end of this portion. I do want to just comment on a couple of other hypergastrinemia points. So we talked a little bit about retained antrum syndrome before. So these are non-Zollinger-Ellison syndrome causes of gastric hypersecretion. Retained antrum syndrome is after a Billroth 2. There's a small part of the antrum that still has some pyloric glands and G cells left to the duodenal bulb in this afferent loop. And in the intact stomach, that's left behind, the G cell function in a normal state is inhibited by acid, but the retained antrum is just getting bathed in duodenal secretions and no longer is getting inhibited by exposure to gastric acid. And so there's no negative feedback on gastrin, and this afferent limb just has, even in though there are a smaller number of them, these G cells are just hypersecreting because there's no negative feedback from acid. And so they actually cause acid secretion in the remaining stomach. It's no longer attached to. And this can cause some postoperative ulcer, and these can be recurrent ulcers and difficult to treat. chronic gastric outlet obstruction, primarily from distension and retained food, which is, remember, food, especially proteins in the antrum, sitting around G cells are one of the main stimuli of gastrin secretion. And so gastric outlet obstruction can do that as well. And then antral G-cell hyperplasia is something you may hear about, where there's basal hypergastrinemia that has a marked increase postprandially or after eating. This is often seen with Helicobacter pylori-associated antral predominant gastritis. And some people are moving towards calling this antral G-cell hyperfunction. And then the last point to make, two points to make, I suppose. One is that in short gut patients, so if you have an extensive small bowel resection, there are hormones like secretin and some others from the small bowel that actually do inhibit gastric acid secretion. They're referred to as a class as enterogastrones. But if you just remember, in any patient that has significant small bowel resection, when you look at the guidelines for the management of these patients, it often involves the use of proton pump inhibitors because they have this loss of this brake or inhibitor to gastrin secretion. They're hypergastrinemic, and that can sometimes cause peptic ulcer disease. That typically is worse in the first 12 months, and so that's not necessarily a lifelong alteration, but in the first 12 months after you lose those enterogastrones and the inhibition of gastric acid secretion, it's something to be aware of, and many times those patients are just put on proton pump inhibitor therapy with the expectation that that's going to be the case. Lastly, there are some channelopathies related to predominantly thought to cause long QT syndrome. And these can impair potassium secretion into the gastric lumen. That can reduce the gradient that's needed for the potassium or hydrogen potassium ATPase pump to function. And so these patients with channelopathies can become at least relatively achlorhydric. This can cause hypergastrinemia, iron deficiency, anemia as well. And so just to be aware of that, since that's something you may not have heard about before. So I think that's going to wrap up this section on gastrin. This is a little longer section, but the remainder should be shorter. But I think gastrin is just something that is really the center of our organ system, comes up a lot on board exams, and I think it's important to be able to think through a bit when we have patients who have elevated gastrins and ulcers as to what's causing it. So I hope you enjoyed, and we'll wrap up and continue with CCK or cholecystokinin next. So this is going to be a quicker segment. We're going to talk about cholecystokinin and secretin, and then we'll wrap up with sort of a hodgepodge of other topics. So cholecystokinin, very similar to gastrin, instead of the final four amino acids that are amidated serving as the primary biologically active portion, it's the final five that are also amidated. There's a tyrosine, seven amino acids from the C-terminus that's sulfated, and this seems to give a lot of the specificity to cholecystokinin compared to gastrin. As we talked about before, they can stimulate each other's receptors, but there's a much higher affinity, near a thousandfold, of the CCK1 receptors in the pancreatobiliary system for cholecystokinin as compared to gastrin. CCK comes from the enteroendocrine eye cells of the duodenum, more than the jejunum, more distal bowel. It's also located in the neurons, though, of the brain and the enteric nervous system. We'll talk a little bit about that in the next portions as far as stimuli and inhibitors of cholecystokinin. The main stimulation for cholecystokinin is fatty acids, less so amino acids. There are also some paracrine peptides that are released from the pancreas and the gastric and intestinal mucosa. So the pancreas, the ACNR cells release something called monitor peptide, and that is a stimuli for cholecystokinin release. And then CCK releasing protein is released from enterocytes in the gastric and intestinal mucosa. And then acetylcholine via the vagus nerve can also stimulate cholecystokinin release. Inhibitors include three main things: somatostatin, pancreatic peptide. So the pancreas is secreting both the monitor peptide, which acts as a stimuli, and pancreatic peptide, which is an inhibitor. And also trypsin, which indirectly acts as an inhibitor by hydrolyzing CCK releasing peptide and monitor peptide. What does cholecystokinin do? Most important thing that it probably does is to increase the release of enzymes from the pancreas and to contract the gallbladder. So a little bit more detail about those. So CCK does stimulate some fluid release from the pancreas. That fluid is particularly rich in enzymes. So the original name given to cholecystokinin was actually pancreozymin. The fluid and bicarbonate release is more so triggered by secretin, which is our next topic of discussion. So enzyme-rich pancreatic secretions. It's one thing cholecystokinin does. The other thing it does is gets bile out into the intestine to deal with the fatty acids that were the stimulus or primary stimulus for its production. So it does that by increasing bile production, causing gallbladder contraction, and causing relaxation of the sphincter of Oddi. In addition to enzyme-rich pancreatic fluid secretion and getting bile out into the intestine, it also works to cause satiety. And it does that in a couple of ways. One is by inhibiting gastric emptying. The other is actually through the central nervous system via vagal nerve afferents that basically trigger a decrease in appetite. CCK is used sometimes with HIDA scans to get an enhanced HIDA scan with gallbladder ejection fraction. It's used in sphincter of Oddi manometry, and it has historically been used at times to try to reproduce biliary pain when all other testing is equivocal. Secretin. So secretin is produced by the S cells, or the specialized neuroendocrine cells of the small intestine. Stimuli are in an acidic environment. So some sources say under 4.5 has a pH. Some say 2 to 4.5, acidic environment. And then products of protein digestion. Inhibitors include the opposite, an alkaline pH. And it actually brings about an alkaline pH. So like many feedback loops, that actually leads to its ultimate inhibition. Other things that cause alkaline pH environments can also do the same thing. So proton pump inhibitors and H2 receptor antagonists. So what does secretin do? By far, its most important function is to stimulate pancreatic fluid and bicarbonate secretion. There are receptors on the duct and ACNR cells of pancreas for secretin to act on. So think about just a big bath of alkaline fluid to deal with the acidic chyme that's coming from the stomach. It does work a bit on enzyme stimulation, but remember that was primarily CCK's job. And so it's thought that secretin potentiates the effect of CCK and acetylcholine on stimulating the pancreas to produce enzyme-rich fluid, but that it is not a primary function of secretin. It also does a similar thing in the bile duct. So it causes biliary secretion of fluid and bicarb. it has trophic effects, like many of the other peptides we've talked about. Growth of the exocrine pancreas is seen in the setting of CCK as well as secretin. So both of those are trophic hormones for the exocrine pancreas. Because of these effects that we've noted, it is sometimes referred to as nature's antacid. And then it also stimulates the chief cells of the stomach to produce pepsinogen, which is then hydrolyzed to the active form pepsin. And then lastly, it can stimulate some insulin release. Again, it's a trophic hormone for the pancreas. The last couple points to make are just some of the clinical uses of secretin. And so in gastric secreting tumors, so Zollinger-Ellison syndrome, normally secretin decreases or inhibits gastrin release. And it does so by stimulating somatostatin. It inhibits gastrin release directly by targeting the G cells. These are lesser effects of it, but it also down-regulates parietal cell function of the hydrogen-potassium pumps. In gastrinomas, secretin injection, as we talked about before, causes a paradoxical increase in gastrin levels. And if it increases by more than 120 picograms per milliliter, that is biochemically the way that we often end up making a diagnosis of Zollinger-Ellison syndrome. It has been used in the past to try to diagnose sort of an accentuated method of diagnosing pancreatic insufficiency by measuring enzyme production before and after secretin stimulation. Historically, it had been used to help cannulate with difficult ERCPs. And then lastly, we sometimes use secretin-enhanced MRCPs to diagnose congenital inflammatory neoplastic conditions of the pancreas. And this is just a bit more of a dynamic form of testing than the standard MRCP. So that can sometimes be used to sort of accentuate the imaging. That's going to wrap up the section on CCK and secretin, and we will end with the next session, which is going to be on somatostatin, motilin, and a few other quick ones to run through, and then we'll be done with gastrointestinal peptides, and you'll be very excited. All right, stay tuned. So wrapping up somatostatin, it is predominantly found in the antrum in the D cells, D as in dog. It's also found in the duodenum and pancreatic islet cells. It has hormone and paracrine functions, which we'll discuss, and then it indirectly decreases acid secretion by preventing release of gastrin and histamine. So main stimuli include meal ingestion and low pH, and then inhibitors are vagal tone. What does it do? So somatostatin suppresses the release of most GI and pancreatic hormones, and that from a pancreas standpoint, it's actually most of the exocrine and endocrine hormones. At the level of parietal cells, it blocks adenylyl cyclase, which is what is activated with the G-coupled protein receptors to basically stimulate and move acid pumps to the apical side of parietal cells. So basically shuts down the function of parietal cells from a secretion standpoint. It decreases gastric emptying and decreases gallbladder contraction. It has a very short half-life of just a few minutes, and so there are some longer-acting analogs like octreotide, which has a, when given intravenously or subcutaneously, has a half-life of about 90 minutes, and then there's longer-acting formulation, lanreotide. Clinically, there are rare somatostatinomas. The symptoms those patients often get are diabetes mellitus, basically from blocking the function of insulin, diarrhea due to malabsorption, and then there's some reduction in somatostatin production by Helicobacter pylori. And then in some of the clinical situations that it is used, so I think we probably most commonly encounter its use as sort of a Hail Mary in AVM disease, where we're going in and trying to debulk them and APC them, clip them if they're actively bleeding. But many patients just have them in difficult to reach situations. And so when we've tried IV iron and keeping ahead of the losses, sometimes we end up trying octreotide or lanreotide. And the thought behind that is that it reduces splanchnic blood flow and may decrease some flow to those AVMs. It's also used sometimes in diarrheal states, so HIV, diarrhea that's refractory, watery diarrhea, hypokalemia, achlorhydria, that is sometimes a syndrome basically seen with VIPomas, can sometimes help with that, as well as carcinoid syndrome, predominantly helping the diarrhea and flushing. And then sometimes as well in dumping syndrome. And then lastly, somatostatin is used in imaging. So radio-labeled octreotide scans can be helpful, as most neuroendocrine tumors have some degree of somatostatin receptors, which helps to basically light up when using radio-labeled octreotide imaging. Motilin is quick. It's released cyclically every 90 minutes while fasting. It triggers, there's an important role in triggering migrating motor complexes or MMCs. And this can be blocked by atropine, it can be blocked by the ingestion of a mixed meal. Motilin is increased by acid and fat in the duodenum, and it is thought that this may be some of the reason why erythromycin works as a somewhat of a prokinetic agent, and is that it stimulates motilin receptors, and those are in stomach and small bowel, at least the proximal small bowel. It's also part of the reason it's thought that erythromycin had such a high adverse events ratio as far as patients complaining of abdominal pain and cramping. Gastric inhibitory peptide, or GIP, inhibits gastric secretion. It's a strong stimulus for insulin secretion. And this is the main, one of the main players as far as hormones, that explains why an oral glucose stimulus is greater than an IV glucose stimulus to stimulate the pancreas to make insulin from the beta cells. There are a few other quick ones to run through. Enteroglucagon is in the secretin family. It's made in intestinal L cells, and there are three different forms. One of the more common ones, GLP-1, is an insulin releaser, a stimulus, even in the setting of not having hyperglycemia. It inhibits gastric secretion and emptying, and it is an important component of the ileal brake. So it blocks gastric and pancreatic secretions and motility when lipids and carbohydrates enter into the ileum. Pancreatic polypeptide, we talked about before, as an inhibitor of it basically blocks pancreatic bicarb and enzyme secretion. and was one of the inhibitors of secretin stimulation. And it's stimulated by almost any meal component. And then peptide YY also may have some degree of function in the ileal brake system. Its stimulus are meals, especially high-fat meals, and inhibits gastric secretion and emptying, and inhibits intestinal motility, which may help enhance digestion and absorption. And then as we wrap up with, I think, the final two or three quick ones, so VIP, vasointestinal peptide, works in the nerves of the gut, relaxes smooth muscle of the gut through nitric oxide mediated mechanisms. It causes increased secretion of many things. VIPomas can cause something called pancreatic cholera or watery diarrhea, hypokalemia, achlorhydria, that are sometimes treated with somatostatin. So you can kind of think of VIPoma, relaxes smooth muscle of the gut, may have some role in the lower esophageal sphincter tone. When it's secreted by a tumor, though, it just kind of causes increased secretion of everything, and we often use somatostatin analogs to treat that. Gastric releasing peptide or bombesin is found in a gastric mucosa. It increases gastrin release. It's released by vagal stimulation. And then enkephalins, which are briefly mentioned, are in the mucosa and the muscle of the gut. They increase smooth muscle tone. And again, that's basically it. So I think in kind of wrapping this section up, I think having a general sense of the difference between hormones, paracrine peptides, and neurocrine, having probably the strongest, if you want to review anything, probably the sections on gastrin, CCK, and secretin, a little bit less so in somatostatin, and then what follows. I hope this is helpful. This is a little bit more of a complicated section. I think we're planning to return to gastric motility, small bowel motility, and then large bowel motility in the next three sections. And so hopefully those give your brain a little bit of a rest. I hope this is helpful. Please send comments via email to me, which should be included in the podcast link. All right. Thank you much.